son of Dusty Rhodes. Dustin Thursday, the Azuka, put down the 30 seconds. And unfortunately, Dustin is down to his knees.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Wrestling Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Everyone, and welcome to episode 142 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson. And today, because it is Survivor Series season, with it coming up on the 24th of this month, I figured I would go back to the year 1990 for a look at WWF Superstars from November 3rd of that year, several weeks before Survivor Series that year in Hartford, which, well, I'll get into it. It's not the greatest Survivor Series of all time, but it's something that I enjoy watching so much that I actually just finished watching it again for probably the 38th time, just a few minutes before I started recording this. But before I get into all that and on this Superstars show, let me get my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown at gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GFAllentownPod. That is at GFAllentownPod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed and more on the shows that you can hear on Pro Wrestling Only for this week coming up a little bit later on in the show. Now, this year is the latest that American Thanksgiving can be, being the 28th of November this year. But this past weekend would have been the last time I could go anywhere because I'm going to be in Florida the next two Saturdays or flying down there and then flying back. But it meant it was the last time I could go to the mall without it turning into a zoo on Saturday, which is good. But I think I'll get more into that next week because I like the mall. And I would like to explain why, with one very, very notable exception that I will never enjoy. But later this past Saturday, I went to this place in Boston. It's actually a brewery outside Boston, but they opened a location on Lovejoy Wharf, which is kind of near TD Garden. It's Night Shift Brewing Company. Now, I had been to the Everett location several times. In fact, I even have a keychain from there. And the beer is very good, but you know, you walk into that place. It's very large. I mean, they're definitely going for that whole beer hall thing that Jack's Abbey certainly accomplished out in Framingham, Mass. But I was fascinated by two things while I was there. Number one, looking around, and yes, there were some, you know, parents with children there, but my thought was, I'm the oldest person here who is not here with his kid, because it was all hipster 33-year-olds at oldest, and then there I am. I'm there too. And then just to get my mind off that and the Alabama-LSU game, which I lost for Vinny Vegas Corner last week, is I started thinking about this brewery, which started up 5-6 years ago. And all I could think about was, how do they raise the capital to do something like this? Now, my wife said, clearly they just borrowed the money. But I really think that they went out and, you know, got some venture capital for something like this because they saw a good opportunity. And I don't know, I'm kind of fascinated with the financials of breweries because, you know, at one time I actually thought about starting a brewery myself, but it would have been helpful if I had gone to college for business instead of journalism. I mean, I guess, you know, going to journalism school helped me to do a podcast that I don't make money on some 20 years later. But, you know, the lesson is, hey, kids, if you're listening to this, go to business school, okay, when you go for undergrad, because that's going to help you way more in the long run. That was not the only lesson to be learned on that particular Saturday evening, walking down to Downtown Crossing and going to a place called J.M. Curly's. Or I can't remember if it's J.M. Curly's or just Curly's, but it's a very good bar, very good restaurant. It's the best fried chicken in the city and the best burger that I've had in the city of Boston. So please tuck that away if you're coming to the city of Boston for SummerSlam 2020, because I would totally be down for going there. You know, two things that are like the best that you could have in the city. I mean, you really can't beat it. So Keithy meets us there, and the lesson we learn from him is, you know, I don't know how the hell this topic came up, but it was, Keithy, can you remember the names of all the women that you've had sex with? Now, it's not like he's a Lothario who's gone out and had sex with 4,200 women. He's not Wilt Chamberlain. But, you know, I guess he's, you know, set his table over the years. Well, the problem is he can't remember all the people. Like, he can't remember names. As this conversation is going along, you know, the attention turns to me. It's like, oh, well, do you know all the names? And I go back into the memory bank, and I'm thinking, I could probably get most of them, except for maybe one or two. Now, this is one of those things where, honestly, if you score above 85%, I think you're doing okay. I don't think you've committed any sort of crime. So I don't see what the big deal is. So I just kind of play off like, yeah, I think I could do good on that test if you quiz me. Even if, you know, I would have to maybe just invent one and say, oh yeah, yeah, I know that. I mean, it's not like I'm Wilt Chamberlain either. But I suppose the lesson from all of that is, if you have sex with somebody, write down their name. You're more likely to retain the information if you write it down. I mean, that's why I've gone through 6 or 7 notebooks in the course of doing this podcast over the last 2.5 years. So after dinner had concluded, Keithy departs, and a friend of mine from high school, his band is playing up in Bolton, Massachusetts, which isn't exactly close to the city of Boston. It's probably a good 37 miles, but it's pretty much all highway to get there. And as we pull up, and I'm like, well, how am I going to find this place? And I remembered, oh, yeah, that's right. There are no real businesses in Bolton. It's going to be the place with lights on that's on the main road. We pull in there, and I just take one look from the outside, and I'm thinking that I'm going to walk in there, and it's going to be like Otis Day in the Nights when wait till Otis sees us.
Wait till Otis sees us! He loves us!
We are gonna die.
I mean, it wasn't quite like that. In fact, it was almost the exact opposite of Night Shift, in that I was probably one of the younger people in there, although I think the oldest out of all the people from my graduating high school class that were there. 6 out of the 162 were in that little tiny building in Bolton, Mass, in the middle of nowhere. And the lesson with that is, if you want to maintain something like your friendships from high school from 20, 25 years ago in this era of social media, do try to make an effort to do that, and don't be lazy about it. Probably wearing out that clip with all the life lessons learned over the weekend, so why don't I get right into it? Because it is Survivor Series season, and the 1990 edition wasn't necessarily the best one. But for whatever reason, and I'm probably in the minority of this, I like to go back and watch that one more than, say, the 89 show. I mean, 91 probably still a little bit more, although you have to watch Tuesday in Texas in tandem with that. At least that's the way I feel. But 1990 being unusual for two things, the egg and for the match of survival at the end, something that they didn't do ever again. They were probably correct to not bring that back, because it made the show feel kind of weird, and I'm not just talking about the how did they decide which two guys were going to be on which side. But there's so many other memorable things, even just beyond the egg and the match of survival. And I've talked about these things on the podcast, and I'm going to talk about them again now, and I'm probably going to talk about them again in the future, because they're the reason why I put that thing on just a couple of hours before I started recording this. Axe literally giving less of a shit than anybody in the history of pay-per-view, huffing his way through his 2 minutes in that match with his very, very puffy hair and just like not caring about anything. It was just spectacular, and I would like to be like that someday. I would like to be able to give that little of a shit about something that I'm doing professionally. Oh yeah, the debut of The Undertaker. Yeah, that's kind of thrown in there too as a mystery partner. Probably the greatest mystery partner in WWF history. I mean, I can't think of one any better than that, or that played out any better. The Visionaries all surviving as a team. Now, this is going to be a Survivor Series report segment on this edition of Superstars, so I'll go more into this, you know, like the quote, saving Tugboat for later because they didn't tag Tugboat into the match, the Hulkamaniacs. I love that. It's like, well, clearly Tugboat must have been nursing some sort of injury, or he's so lousy they don't want to put him in there until the very end. He's like the last guy. He's like that Rule 5 pick in the bullpen. It's like, we're only putting him in if the score is 9-1, whether we're ahead or behind. Oh, yes, and how could I forget about my favorite bad match of all time, the Mercenaries against the Alliance, of led by Nikolai Volkoff, just because of the way how rushed that match is. I love it so much, and it just, like, all the background of it, it is a quintessential professional wrestling match, because on one side, you have a actual Croatian who's billed himself as being from Russia for a very long time, but has actually lived in Baltimore for a very long time. You got an American who's billed from Mexico, and not only just Mexico, Tukula, Mexico, which is totally fake, as I said last week. It's fake. Tukula, Mexico is fake. There's a Toluca, Mexico, but hey. Then you get the Bushwhackers. They're from New Zealand, which is, you know, so random because New Zealand is actually left off some maps. I saw something on that on the John Oliver last week or this week with John Oliver. I don't even remember what it's called because I stopped watching it because he just started annoying me at a certain point. And on the other side, you have, first of all, the entire Mercenaries team has their face paint. You know, I should probably save some of this for later, but Slaughter is Iraqi turncoat. You have an actual Iraqi who's basically a lookalike, a decoy Saddam Hussein outside the ring. You got Fuji there, who is an American playing Japanese, just like Pat Tanaka. And then you got Akio Sato, who looks like Judge Ito. And then Boris Zukov, who's an American from Virginia, pretending to be a Russian. So it reminds me of why I love wrestling so much. In fact, I didn't just watch the 1990 Survivor Series. I watched the first 20 minutes of the Wrestling Challenge episode from this same weekend, which I could have done that one just as much. But I'm just laughing my ass off at the entire thing. I am wildly entertained by everything that's going on. Entertained? Oh, wow. The accent was bad on that one. I haven't even started drinking today. Oh, my goodness. So, on this show, we're going to see, on the Brother Love show, Bobby the Brain Heenan, which I had a low expectation for because we're in late stage Brother Love, because he gets written off at the beginning of 91. You know, he's going to be managing The Undertaker come Survivor Series time. So, you know, him and, you know, on that talk show kind of fades out for me a little bit. But also, we're going to see the Bushwhackers. They're in the opening match. And Mr. Perfect, where I will discuss his very interesting 1990, where I have an alternate idea if they could have just not done one thing that would have made the future so much brighter, I think, for not only him, but for another guy. And Sergeant Slaughter, the leader, the fearless leader of the Mercenaries, who overcame a 4-on-1 and nearly pulled it out in the end, but for Howard Finkel's Sergeant Slaughter has been disqualified, with the long pause in the middle. And how could I forget the feature of this show, the hook, if you will, to, in the parlance of one half of this match's dad, Dustin Rhodes taking on the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. And what I will discuss with that is this a diabolical plan on the part of Dusty Rhodes, or are they just rerunning an old angle that has been done in other territories? Or could it potentially be both? Now, this taping was in Springfield, Illinois on October 9th, so we had a good almost a month of lead time. This is the second of three Superstars on this. And interesting note from this taping, Scotty the Body The man who would become Raven had a tryout match against Coco Beware. And it's very interesting to think of him trying to slot him, even if he maintains this Scotty the Body persona. They call him something else because WWF, they would. Picturing the man who would become Raven, which I know it kind of makes him sound like the man they call Vader, but I can never remember if it's Scott Levy or Scott Levy, so that's why I'm just going to call him the man that would become Raven. Picturing him, slotting him in to 91, 92 WWF, I mean, would he just be like the flip side of the Rockers? He would be like the heel version of that? I think so. And this is also the first episode of Superstars with the new entrance theme, or intro theme, which is basically the Ultimate Warriors entrance music, modified to an extent. And for whatever reason, they decided to have the Warrior shooting laser beams out his freaking eyes. I don't know. I can imagine Vince McMahon as Dr. Evil, like, "God damn it, pal. I wanted the Ultimate Warrior shooting laser beams out of his freaking eyes." But that is how we stand in the WWF as we approach the 1990 Survivor Series. So without any further ado, we'll just jump into it. WWF Superstars from November 3rd, 1990.
If you or someone you love is tortured by premenstrual syndrome...
Not torture.
I meant me.
It's Roseanne's time of the month.
Do I have to spell it out for you?
I love you.
PMS. Roseanne, followed by Coach, Tuesday.
When do I get my PMS?
I'm not sure why that would make me want to watch Roseanne on ABC on the following Tuesday. I mean, I guess Coach was coming up next. It was the episode where Christine and Hayden end up breaking up because Hayden talks about his plans for the future to Christine's friends and doesn't mention Christine in any of it. But yeah, I was never in on Roseanne. Yeah, maybe I watched it a time or two, but I didn't particularly care for the show. I mean, I guess the premise... I think the premise has been done, you know, in other places a lot better. I mean, even Good Times where you got, like, the poor family, and yeah, there was some over-the-top characters in that show, which is probably why the two parents quit at various points. But it's television. It's entertainment. You're going to have over-the-top characters. Nothing has to be gritty in real life like everything was in the 70s. So that's enough sitcom pontificating by me. As our hosts for this episode of Superstars, and this was kind of a nice little treat, Vince McMahon, Rowdy Roddy Piper, and the Macho King, Randy Savage. This would be the first time, I believe, that these three are in the booth together. So you'd see them for much of the following year once Savage loses the retirement match at WrestleMania 7. Now, I've been posting a lot of these on Twitter, what I like to call Chamber of Commerce Vince, or Tour Guide Vince, however you want to have it, where he tells you what's going on in the town. Well, this is Springfield, Illinois. There's not a whole lot going on, you know, other than corruption in the state government. But you still get a pretty good intro out of it, given all the personalities.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Vince McMahon, and joining me here in the land of Lincoln is not Honest Abe. No, it's Rowdy Rod, the Hot Rod Rowdy Roddy Piper. And joining me as well is the John Wilkes Booth of the World Wrestling Federation, the Macho King, Randy Savage.
Yeah, glory, glory, hallelujah. It's the Macho King here in the land of Lincoln. To make an Emancipation Proclamation, I'm going to free the Ultimate Warrior, free him of that championship belt that he wears around his waist. Ooh, yeah. Mine eyes have seen the glory, Ultimate Warrior, and you will feel the fateful lightning of my terrible swift sword. Ooh, yeah. The madness is marching on. Ooh, yeah. Dig it.
I do think it's a little strange that Vince McMahon compares Randy Savage with a presidential assassin, the guy who shot Abraham Lincoln, our greatest president. I wanted to be somebody to yell out "too soon" from the background, but unfortunately, we're just going to have to settle for the Macho King looking quite sharp in the silver outfit. This is where he's definitely started to evolve into what would basically become his look for at least his WWF tenure through the 90s. Of course, once he gets to WCW, he starts dressing in Hogan's colors for a little while, which is quite unfortunate. As they tell us what's coming up on the program, and the little picture of Ted DiBiase and Dustin Rhodes, I don't think I've ever seen a homelier-looking fellow than Dustin Rhodes in that little photograph. I mean, good Lord, that was the best picture they could get of Dustin Rhodes out of all of them. And he had wrestled some, I guess, you know, non-TV matches up to this point, and he had been in the business for a couple of years at this time, despite his young age. So why don't we get into the first match, which is the Bushwhackers taking on the team of Bob Bradley, who's been around forever in 1990, and Spike Jones. As the Bushwhackers are doing their usual march to the ring, they actually take a detour over to the Egg, which somebody called it on one of the, maybe it was the challenge that I watched, like, oh, it's a turkey egg, or they called it a turkey egg. Like, no, because then only a turkey would come out of the egg. Turns out that they're actually more correct than not. But it was a classic example. I talked about this, I want to say it was like episode 42 or 41. It was another Superstars episode from just after the Survivor Series, where it was built too well, in my opinion. They built it like a wrestling angle, but because it was only intended to be something like a mascot, it was built up too well in people's minds going in that they were bound to be disappointed. So it is funny. And by the way, The Undertaker was never coming out of that egg. That would have been just beyond stupid. But like, that great debut, and then you had one of the worst debuts all in the same show. Just a, you know, another great Survivor Series 1990 thing. So the Bushwhackers, and yeah, you know, they are what they are. They're a comedy team. Maybe I appreciate the comedic elements more now. Still not a huge fan of their work because they're gross. I don't really like people, you know, head licking. Like, what the hell? I mean, what is going on here? So I thought to myself, the name Bushwhackers, I mean, I know what a sheep herder is. It's a guy who tends the sheep and probably f*** them in his spare time. But there is an actual origin to the term bushwhackers and bushwhacking, and not like something you would pull from the Urban Dictionary where it's got something to do with, well, I've already said enough. So bushwhacking was a form of guerrilla warfare common during the American Revolutionary War, American Civil War, and other conflicts in which there were large areas of contested land and few governmental resources to control these tracts. This was particularly prevalent in rural areas during the Civil War, where there were sharp divisions between those favoring the Union and the Confederacy in the conflict. The perpetrators of the attacks were called bushwhackers. The term bushwhacking is still in use today to describe ambushes done with the aim of attrition. All that makes me think of is not the Civil War, but the Revolutionary War in the movie The Patriot. So I guess Mel Gibson's character in that would be something of a bushwhacker, except for the fact that he kind of had cause to do that after, you know, he's trying to rescue Heath Ledger from the evil British guys, including the general or the colonel who looked like Conan O'Brien. Go back and watch The Patriot. The colonel or general that gets shot by him who had come to the house, he looks like Conan O'Brien. I don't know. It always kind of throws me off when I watch that movie, which I think is far too often. But it was apparently more of a Civil War thing. So the name itself is more merchandise friendly, I think, than sheep herders. So that's why the WWF had to change the name. I mean, you can't argue with how much money they were able to make selling all the silly merch with the hats and all that. I mean, hey, I'm not going to argue with it, even if I didn't particularly like it. Not everything on this program is going to be for me. So in 1990, the Bushwhackers start out with the Rougeaus at the Royal Rumble, where Jacques has the full beard and the sad jobber face on his way to the ring there. They move on to Rhythm and Blues at WrestleMania 6, where they don't have a match, but just mercifully interrupt the concert performance at the Sky Dome. And by the end of the year, they're with the Orient Express and actually losing on a regular basis. The Bushwhackers are there, as I said, as a comedy team. They really don't need to go over anybody. You know, they could be there to just build up heel teams. Unless, of course, you're talking about the Rougeaus, in which case they beat the Rougeaus soundly every single time, it seems. And Luke Williams and Bob Bradley start, they slug it out. And Bradley, I don't know what the hell he was doing here. He does a backflip and then an elbow. It was almost like he was doing a handspring back elbow, but instead of like springing into the back elbow, he basically just did a flip, stood there, and threw an elbow. It was like the flip was totally inconsequential to what was going on. There was no point to that move. Get a distraction by Butch on the apron, who then bites his ass. There's not a lot of ass biting. The Our Vantage Point podcast tweeted out something with the Doink and Dink and all the midgets with against Lawler from Survivor Series 94, the Flair Steamboat of comedy matches, I might add. Well, there was an ass-biting spot in that one involving referee Danny Davis. Spike Jones gets in, and we know where this is going, because Bob Bradley is the respected jobber, and this particular team, they're only going to be allowed one tag. I've said this before. The enhancement teams, if they're allowed two tags, that's a great sign of respect, but usually they're only going to be allowed one. Get the battering ram on Spike Jones, and this is a rather long double team by the Bushwhackers. I mean, Jesse Ventura would be having a heart attack if he had to watch this, and the Gutbuster mercifully finishes off Spike Jones, and I could just move on from this Bushwhacker match.
From the pages of the World Wrestling Federation magazine, here's Update.
All right, hi again, everyone. Last week, Jake the Snake Roberts made his first appearance back on the Brother Love Show since sustaining eye injuries as a result of an alleged accident at the hands of the model Rick Martel.
It was 4 weeks earlier where Jake had the arrogance sprayed in his eyes by Rick Martel, who you're wondering why he was there. Around that period, and they had kind of built to it in a very subtle fashion, Martel would be out at the beginning of the Brother Love segment spraying arrogance everywhere to kind of, I don't know if, like, Brother Love had, like, a farting issue or whatever, but apparently they needed to make it smell nice for the guests, and that's why Martel was out there, and it was building to this thing where he was trying to spray into the snake bag, and Jake took offense to that, rightly, and ended up, taking one in the eye. Now, instead of just getting pink eye from the whole thing, you know, he completely loses his sight, and we go back to the doctor at the time on that episode, and he says, 1 week from now, we will know more about this. Like, what a coincidence that you're going to know exactly a week from now when the next edition of Superstars is on. But, okay, episodic television. So now we're reviewing the previous week's edition of Superstars, in which Jake appeared on the Brother Love Show with his eye injury and sunglasses on, and having agent Tony Garea lead him out as a sort of seeing eye dog of sorts. And I can't think of anybody better than Tony Garea to be your seeing eye dog.
I have my eye on a couple of young boys, and hopefully if things work out, we can get together, and I'd like to try it for a sixth time.
Well, as I talked about in the intro, I hope Garea wrote down the names of those five boys. Like, okay, so he's leading Jake out, like, hey, Jake, hold my hot dog. That's not a hot dog. Just thinking about blinding angles, they're really not much of a WWF thing. Not done, I mean, it seemed to be done more in other territories, with the most famous being the Junkyard Dog and the Freebirds in Mid-South in 1980. Oh, he can't see his daughter be born. That's how you played into the emotion at that time. I'm wondering, is this something that definitely would not work today because there's too much of a suspension of disbelief? I don't know, because I'm not sure anybody's going to try that, but maybe it will happen soon. But no matter what you do to Jake, and I'm not talking about, you know, his various substance abuse issues. You know, you can take away his sight, you can take away his, you know, well, maybe not his hearing, but, you know, it would make things more difficult. But he's still going to go out there and he's going to cut a great promo every single time.
Martel, you may have taken the one thing that every man needs to see a child grow. And you may have taken the one thing that a man needs to see the beauty of life. But I promise you, if you will lead me the way, if you will show me the spot, whether it's in the back, whether it's outside, whether it's in front of these people, brother, remember this, an eye for an eye.
That's the second greatest promo of all time that ends with eye for an eye behind Dusty Rhodes at the end of 1988. Violence for the sake of violence, an eye for an eye. It's still pretty damn good. It's at this point that Martel comes out, just to be a dick. I don't know if he's wearing the giant button that says, yes, I am a model, which is just so goddamn great. And he's just generally a dick, like, hey, over here, how many fingers am I holding up? Oh, good stuff.
Wait a minute, Martel's coming back.
You want me? Here I am. Hey, can't you see what you look like?
Show him his finger! Ooh, no!
Rick Martel took a while to get going as a heel, but he is so great here. I mean, let's think about this just objectively. He has come out from the back to taunt a man that he has blinded and then pokes him in the eye just to be a jerk and then runs away before he could grab him. And Brother Love is the one who ends up getting DDT'd because Jake just sort of grabs whatever head and neck he can find and DDT's him. And Pritchard, to his credit, Bruce Pritchard took a hell of a DDT there. Considering I think he was wearing those glasses. And, you know, that can't be easy getting DDT, taking a face-first bump when you got those on their face. And then Jake, you know, because his glasses fell off, he turns to the camera and you get that white contact lens to kind of simulate, like, oh, we can't see the pupil anymore. And that was legitimately freaky, seeing that on television at that time. But I can't get over what a delightful dink that Rick Martel is as the model. Yeah, I know. He was one of the great baby faces of the 1980s. The times change, things evolve, and he had to do this for a while. And it worked, quite frankly. It worked once he became the model, when he's just Rick Martel and he's hanging out with Slick. That didn't work so well.
Jake the Snake, take a look at the truth, if you can. You know, when arrogance was sprayed in your eyes, I said it was an accident. I felt sorry for you. Well, now I take everything back. It wasn't an accident. I did it on purpose, and I'm happy about it. So now, Jake, now you see me. Now you don't.
The thing I love about Martel is in no way is he trying to be a cool heel or appeal to anybody. And I know things were different back then, but I think anybody today who wants to be a true wrestling heel could stand to look at Martel's work in 90 and 91 as the model, because I think it would be a model for somebody to kind of work off of in this day and age. Anybody, I think, can learn from what he was doing here. But oh my God, it's just a, oh yeah, I was going to apologize, but I take it all back. I actually did do it on purpose. Oh, he's so good. And if they complained about him having an accent looking in your direction, Bucky Beaver, Kevin Dunn, I mean, give me a break with that. The accent goes with the gimmick so perfectly. If I had somebody who was going to adopt a model gimmick now, I would want him to talk with the exact same French-Canadian accent that Rick Martel has. It's crazy that anybody would think to complain about it, but, you know, sometimes WWE, it's a strange place, and they do things the way that they do, and God forbid anybody talk with an accent, right?
An ABC News brief. Now from Washington, Jack Smith.
Good evening. Iraq flew 4 American hostages to freedom in Jordan today after 3 months of captivity. Baghdad says it released the men because they were sick. Secretary of State Baker is headed to the Middle East for talks on the Persian Gulf crisis. Baker told reporters he'll discuss military action against Iraq in case economic sanctions fail.
That's where everything stood in the Persian Gulf in that weekend in November of 1990. Operation Desert Shield, as it was known, while they were kind of waiting out to see if the sanctions were going to basically end the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, which had to be repelled at a certain point. And it took a while to realize, oh yeah, sanctions alone aren't going to do this. We're going to build a broad international coalition to go into Iraq, which, you know, something that wouldn't be done in the future. But at that point in time, the whole idea is to expel Iraq and their aggression from Kuwait, and really nothing more than that. Not to take anybody out of office or regime change or anything like that, which, well, that's a debate for a different podcast, I think. So we got Sergeant Slaughter, and that's why I played that, because he's, you know, full Iraqing it up, I guess, the Iraq and wrestling connection. He's facing Warren Bianchi, who's a job guy that, for whatever reason, I don't remember, even though he was on TV 25 different times between 1988 and 1992. It's like he's totally right in my wheelhouse, and I don't remember it. At least, certainly not to the extent of the Iraq angle. I should make that a t-shirt. Yeah, Roll Tide, the Iraq and Iraqi wrestling connection. Now, Slaughter, the thing to remember, when he came in, it was basically under, I don't like America anymore. America is soft. Like, our military has gone soft because we've got rapprochement with the Soviet Union. That's the way people felt about detente in the 70s, by the way. So we got to up it a little bit once Operation Desert Shield kicks off. The invasion of Kuwait happens at the beginning of August. So The U.S. sends troops to Saudi Arabia and other places, you know, shortly thereafter. And now we got to make this about him turning on America, becoming pro-Iraq. So what do? We got to bring in Sheikh Adnan al-KC from the AWA because, you know, that place hasn't been raided enough. It's like, wow, talk about luck. How lucky is General Adnan for looking like Saddam Hussein and actually being Iraqi at that point in time as the AWA is going out of business? He debuts on the September 22nd Superstars, so about a month and a half before this. So everything has changed. And Adnan, of course, you know, I've spoken about this before. He would bring his very unique promo style to the WWF.
Well, first of all, I think you should stand.
Can we listen to this for a moment? And
sure.
Maybe Hot Rod, I'm going to ask you for an interpretation.
Okay.
Read something. What do you think about that? You don't know everything, Roddy Piper. I'm a former World Wrestling Federation champion. I'm about to take the belt back. What do you think of that?
Well, let's listen.
What the general just said. Is you maggots! You scum!
I didn't understand it.
Huh? You swine!
He's pointing to you, King.
You pukes ought to be on your feet! Saluting Sergeant Slaughter!
Who does he think
General
he is?
Adnan. Now get off of those chairs and salute!
I'm a little bit peeved at Vince, Piper, and Savage for just talking over all of General Adnan's promo. I mean, who knows if he said something coherent? We'll never know because they just talked over the entire thing. I mean, it could have been a little bit more than the fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la thing that he would always do. But I mean, yeah, I didn't understand it the other times, but maybe I would have this time. Who knows? So they kind of screwed us over in some way. So his tag team partners, Slaughter's, the Mercenaries team, actually, it was a change in that. Originally, it was to be the Orient Express of Tanaka and Sato, alongside the African Dream Akeem. And it was changed to Boris Zhukov in the Orient Express, which kind of a rare situation where the substitution actually made more sense when they actually did. It's like, why didn't you do this way originally? But Akeem was still there, and you were going to use him. So we actually hear from Boris and the Orient Express.
It is great honor to have Sergeant Slaughter as captain of our team.
Sergeant Slaughter, it is great to have you as the leader, one who's had so many victories and will lead us to another victory in the Survivor Series.
And it's funny because Boris Zhukov, if anybody would have a grudge with Sergeant Slaughter, it should be him after the way he was bullied as Private Jim Nelson back in Mid-Atlantic in 1981, which I covered back in episode 72 to check that out in the archives. But let's think about the three guys on that team, okay? And I talked about Pat Tanaka not, you know, particularly caring for Slaughter because I think he eliminated him in the AWA World Title Battle Royal in February of 89, which I believe I covered episode 78. Do check that out in the archives. But they sandbagged Sergeant Slaughter, their fearless leader, despite what they're saying here. This is probably about the point that they got paid, because they are mercenaries, after all. But they all got pinned in the first 2 minutes of the match. So my suggestion to Slaughter in this case, when you're dealing with these other mercenaries, as one himself, he should have known better than to give them their pay entirely ahead of time. They should have followed like you would, you know, if you were hiring a hitman. Not that I would know, but and I don't mean Bret Hart either. You do half now, half later. Just like how you do it in the movies, or you can work out, you know, some sort of different pay. Don't give it all to them up front because there was absolutely no need for them to really try hard. The incentive was removed. So Akeem was removed from the match. The announcement was a week before this, so they got on that Boris Zhukov promo pretty quickly after that. And like I said, it did make sense. It kind of like how Ted DiBiase's Mystery Man, The Undertaker, made a hell of a lot more sense than trotting Bad News Brown out there. It's like, he's supposed to be in the Survivor Series team for the third year in a row. It's like, why can't Honky Tonk Man speak up and be like, hey, this guy's been on my team the last 2 years and he's walked out on us, so maybe we should think about getting somebody else. So Slaughter, he hadn't really given up. Looking at the top of his head, his hair, he was definitely balding, but he hadn't given up on that puff at the front of his hair, almost like he really wanted it for like the Rudy Giuliani-style comb-over. And eventually, he just gives up on it. I mean, by the time, you know, summer of 91, he's just bald on top, and it is what it is. A backbreaker and then a front suplex, followed up by the camel clutch, because he can't use the cobra clutch anymore, because that is the million-dollar dream, and owned by Ted DiBiase. Although, you'd think that maybe a deal could be cut, but What is Slaughter going to offer DiBiase other than maybe muscle at this point for, you know, to have his finishing hold back? So that's why he's stuck. He's doing the camel clutch. And the one thing I'll say about Sarge, yes, it was probably a tasteless angle. I mean, they approached it probably thinking it was no different than having the Iron Sheik parading around for much of the 1980s. But it was very different because, you know, we were putting troops in harm's way, really for the first time since Vietnam, and people were legitimately worried at that time. But Slaughter did a great job in the role because he fully threw himself into it. And, oh yeah, he's very good at professional wrestling. After the match, they go to a broadcast element that always kind of cracks me up, and it's when they show the broadcast area, and they're actually behind Piper, Vince, and Savage, and it's all green screen in front of them. So the fact that they're trying to simulate like they're live in the arena, but they're not actually there, or at least I don't think they are. The video quality on this wasn't particularly great. So Vince is going to show some merchandise, and with it being November now, it's perfect time to promote the WWF calendars for 1991. Well, unfortunately, something about it sets off the Macho King.
You could say to a certain extent that he is a superstar, but if that's the case, that would bring his hot rod to this. The cover of the World Wrestling Federation calendar, the Ultimate Warrior. Take a look at this, Macho King.
Right here in front of these millions of people. You are alive. Right there, buried in the basement.
Get out of here. Come on.
Like that, Piper. How do you like that, Vince McMahon? That's it. That's going wrong in history. I'm a memory.
Savage is pretty upset over the fact that the Ultimate Warrior is on the cover of the calendar that Vince is trying to promote. Now, I don't know if it's just the fact that it's the Warrior, or if it's that it's not the Macho King himself, or if he's upset about his placement in the calendar. And if you ask me, if you could put me in any month in a calendar like that, I would want to be April. I think I would want to be the person on the April. But yeah, Savage flipping out. I'm trying to understand his emotion. It'd be like, kind of like if somebody gave me a calendar that was great quarterbacks in the NFL of the 21st century, and it had like Eli Manning on the cover of it. I think that that would probably set me off into a similar rage as Savage. I don't know if I would walk off because we don't hear from Macho King for the rest of the show. So this trio in the broadcast booth, we're going to have to wait till 91 to hear them again, I guess. And they go right to Sean Mooney in the event center, which is so great because Mooney, he's so great in that he would always have like this cocked eyebrow watching like off to the side, and he would never get flustered by anything. He'd always have like that one little quick rejoinder. I will just never get tired of that. And similar to that, in the event center, we're promoting a show at the Boston Garden on November 11th, which drew 6,500, but only 5,000 paid. Not the greatest show for the Boston Garden, which is used to sell out in the 80s, and here it is less than half full. No events on that day where it was held in the evening. There was a Bruins game the day before. They beat the Washington Capitals 5-3. The Celtics were off, and the Celtics were very good the beginning of that season. They started 29-5, then ran into some injury issues with Larry Bird and some others. I actually went to a preseason NBA game that year. The Celtics were playing the Nuggets, which I thought was strange that Denver would fly all the way out and do a preseason game. But this was the year that the Denver Nuggets had Paul Westhead as their coach, who used to coach Loyola Marymount, and they basically decided that they weren't going to play any defense and they were going to try to score as many points as possible. And it led to some crazy scores, like the Celtics scored 90 points in the first half of a preseason game, which I only got tickets to because I won a raffle at the Boys and Girls Club bingo, the Halloween bingo that it was after school one day. Also on that bet, that bingo, I won the coverall contest where I covered all the squares on my bingo before anybody else there. And I basically won the Noah's Ark of candy, two of every single candy bar that you could think of. So on this Boston Garden show, yeah, there's going to be actual matches and all, but what we're promoting is the Bunkhouse Brawl, which the WWF would actually do. Yeah, when you say Bunkhouse, you think more WCW, NWA, Jim Crockett Promotions, that sort of thing. But WWF would throw that out either if the other promotion was coming in and doing bunkhouse brawls in the area, which I think they did in 87 when Crockett was trying to come into Northeast. So they decided to preempt it by doing the same thing on shows in the Northeast just before it. Or when the WWF is just totally out of ideas and they're just going to throw this out. Hell, here's this match where people are going to come dressed like not in their normal gear. So the participants for this bunkhouse battle royal, these are the guys who are actually in the Bunkhouse Battle Royal, not just the ones that they were promoting in the event center. We had Earthquake, who actually won the damn thing, Roddy Piper, Legion of Doom, Hawk and Animal, Tugboat, Jim Duggan, Saba Simba, Dusty Rhodes, The Hart Foundation, Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart, The Black Demon, Dino Bravo, Crush, Demolition Axe. It was funny, Axe and Crush was the combination, so no Smash. Tito Santana, The Warlord, Boris Zukov, Ted DiBiase, Virgil, and Rhythm and Blues with Greg Valentine and the Honky Tonk Man. So, very interesting. But the best part of this is, you know, I love Survivor Series team promos, and that's a good chunk of why I'm doing this particular show. But we get promos for this Bunkhouse Battle Royal, and what this takes me back to, it's kind of like the homeless man's version of the Royal Rumble promos, where each guy would get to do 20 to 30 seconds saying why they were going to win, like Bad News Brown with the promo that I can't find, but I know it exists somewhere, where he says, Royal Rumble, 29 spineless cockroaches and Bad News Brown. Who do you think's going to win? So stuff like that always delights me to no end. So we're going to hear from a number of people, starting with the guy who was going to win the thing, Earthquake, and I'm very happy because he makes it Boston-centric.
You know, Earthquake, the Boston Celtics can't stop you, baby. The Boston Bruins can't stop you. And everybody in that bunkhouse brawl can't stop you either, Daddy.
You forgot about the Red Sox.
That's right.
But they can't stop me either. There's a lot of history in Boston. But all tea parties have been canceled because everyone will be at the Boston Gardens watching the Earthquake eliminate all the other men so that the Earthquake will win the Bunkhouse Brawl.
I'm going to forgive Earthquake for saying Boston Gardens plural instead of Boston Garden because of Jimmy Hart giving a shout out to the Bruins. I certainly appreciate that. You don't really hear that on a wrestling program. And also for not mentioning the Patriots, because that was the year that they were going 1-15 and you had the sexual harassment thing in the locker room with Lisa Olsen and Zeke Mowat basically showing his dick to the reporter and basically causing great embarrassment to the organization and to the NFL as a whole, which would lead to the NFL basically taking over the team the next year before, well, That's a whole other podcast, the ownership of the Patriots in the early 90s. So now we got Dusty Rhodes. And when you say Bunkhouse Battle Royal, you think, well, Dusty's definitely going to win this. I mean, after all, he won the Bunkhouse Battle Royal in 86, 87, and 88 in Jim Crockett Promotions. One difference, he ain't got the book here.
DiBiase, we talking about a bunkhouse brawl. Come on, y'all. Bring what you got. Get down to it. And all these men you talking about me hiding behind, let me tell you something, brother. In the Boston Gardens, you ain't going to have to look for Dusty Rhodes, the American dream, because I'm going to find you out. And when I do, I'm going to take my Texas boots that I'm going to be wearing, and I'm going to stomp a mud hole in you.
All right, I think he said Boston Gardens and not Boston Garden, but you know what? I'm going to let it go, even though Dusty, when he was doing the suspension angle in JCP in 1988, he actually set it up so that it would not take effect until after JCP's show at the Boston Garden, because Dusty Rhodes, apparently a big Boston Celtics fan. Also, it was one of his first appearances in the WWF in 1989, coincidentally against Ted DiBiase, where he was substituting for Jake the Snake Roberts. But I also counted in the green screen background of Dusty Rhodes' logo, there were 29 polka dots. I don't know why I bothered to count that, but that is how many there were. If you listen to me on the Place to Be podcast this past Monday, with JT Rosero and Scott Criscolo talking about the Saturday Night's Main Event from January of 1990. Once you're done with this, you should download and listen to that one. I counted the Dusty Rhodes, how many polka dots are on his trunks. I don't know why that's a thing that I'm doing now, but, you know, I've seen a lot of Dusty matches in the WWF. I need stuff to look for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
time for the Brother Love Show, which is kind of a callback to the very first one in 1988, because when he was introduced, yes, his benefactor was the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, but to really drive home the point that Brother Love is a heel character, it was Bobby Heenan who went to the podium and brought out his good friend, Brother Love, to host the first edition. It was on Wrestling Challenge, too, so Heenan was being one of the hosts of that program as the color man. Now, Heenan was in a very tough spot at this point in 1990 because one of his most prominent charges, Ravishing Rick Rude, had just left the WWF before the feud with the Big Boss Man could really get underway. You know, the insulting the Big Boss Man's mother, which always struck me as like, why doesn't she just ignore it? I mean, it's just words. I mean, you know, yeah, Boss Man will get upset, but clearly he's going to get a little too violent over the whole thing. So Rude takes off, and now the Boss Man is going after Heenan, which leads to him actually having to do matches, which is why I'm saying he's in a tough spot, okay? This guy had a neck injury to the point where the following year he retires from managing because he just feels like he can't bump the way that he used to anymore. But he's here, he's picking up the slack. Now, Brother Love, he's wearing the neck brace because he's still selling the injury from the DDT the previous week at the hands of Jake the Snake that we saw in the update. Now, Heenan, the other thing is, we talk about Ted DiBiase suits a lot and how those evolved over the years. Bobby Heenan's, what basically his managerial attire, this is my least favorite era of the stuff that he would wear, because he would basically only wear that one tracksuit that said Brain across the back and kind of like the Detroit Tigers classic font or whatever, like the old school, like We the People in the Constitution, basically that kind of writing. I didn't like that one. I liked when he would wear different stuff. I mean, the gold standard is the white WrestleMania 3 one, but you can't really wear that all the time. I mean, that's basically like white tie in terms of wrestling attire. So he's on there. Brother Love, he's clearly, you know, not in good shape. And Heenan is kind of fearing for his life because the Boss Man is coming after him.
You know, Brother Brain, it's one thing to be censored by WWF President Jack Tunney to never be able to say another word about the Big Boss Man's mother.
Give him a box of Kleenex, please.
But it's another to be ordered to step into the ring one-on-one with the Big Boss Man and face that brutality.
Thank you, Brother Love. As hurt as you are to stand out here with me, I appreciate it. But what I'd like to do right now is I would like to sincerely, from the bottom of my heart, apologize to the Big Boss Man's mother. I would like to say, Big Boss Man's mother, I am sorry. Sorry for anything I've said against you or your family. And I'd like to apologize to the rest of the mothers out there if I've offended them. And I sincerely mean that. I am sorry.
It's a lot like those modern public apologies where the if anyone was offended sort of thing. Like, well, I really don't apologize. I only apologize if you were offended. But okay, guess it didn't work for Don Cherry Hockey Night Canada and all that. I'm going to save Ron McLean's ass. I don't know. As I taped this, he still got a job. But even though he was kind of going along with the whole thing and gave the thumbs up. No, one of the great things about this Big Boss Man's mother thing with Heenan is the fact that she has no first name. She's just referred to as the Big Boss Man's mother the entire time. It's like her name's not like Eileen or anything like that. It's like, what? We can't call her by, like, then again, you'd probably have to give her a last name. I mean, her name isn't Eileen Boss Man. Although, actually, it could. I mean, I am one of those people who puts Boss Man as all one word because that's the style guide that I follow. Apologize to the rest of the mothers out there if anybody was offended. Oh, you know, even though I don't like the outfit, it's still classic Heenan.
And can you feel how remorseful I am in my heart? Can you feel my heart? I feel the love, Brother Brian! Can you feel how sorry I am? I feel how sorry you are, Brother Brian! I feel the love in your heart! And tell everybody, I am sorry!
All right. Brother Love going way too much into preacher mode there. But Bobby Heenan could read the phone book. He could read the yellow pages and make that funny. He probably did on an episode of Primetime at some point that I just haven't seen. He's looking through it and trying to crack up Monsoon. I mean, nobody was better at those phone bits than Bobby was. I can't think of anybody who could have possibly done it better than him. So yeah, Brother Love, a little too much of a televangelist there, but I mean, that's what the character is based on. So he eventually asks all of us, I mean, this is really driving the point home, to put our hands on the TV, like the preachers of yore, and feel the, I guess, apology or the remorse come through the television set. And this is going to have to be one of the two show images for this week. Heenan and Brother Love on their knees, kind of, you know, begging, asking for absolution.
Look at Brother Brian! I am sorry, Boss Man! Boss Man's mother, I am sorry! Please believe me from the bottom of my heart! I am sorry! Here on your hands and your knees, and join us in a moment of silent remorse.
A moment of silent remorse. That's remorse.
The whole thing's so crazy, but it's wildly entertaining the way they're going about it. I mean, I know Vince doesn't believe that they're actually apologetic, but, you know, I haven't really seen the kind of fear in Heenan's eyes, in the past. You know, I'm just comparing it to what I've seen from him in the previous 6 years. So something about this does feel a little different. I mean, now he's going to have to actually start working a house show program with this guy. Oh my God, it's so good. This is actually one of the better Brother Love Show segments that I've covered. Such good stuff. You get the feud Boss Man with the greater Heenan family, which I don't know why they couldn't have just done that from the beginning instead of making poor Bobby get in the ring and take a, you know, ball and chain match and have it dropped on his chest or whatever the bit was, like on his stomach or however it would work. And eventually leads to the Boss Man against Perfect for the Intercontinental title. You think, maybe he's going to win the title. He doesn't. But at the end of the day, I love this thing now, like, maybe the goal was the best part of the Boss Man heated feud was the friends that the Boss Man made along the way. Like Andre the Giant, except for the fact that they were already pals because they were partners at SummerSlam 89.
Here they come, father and son.
We went to the father-son barbecue.
You drove all the way up to Fatherson for a barbecue?
I haven't watched Family Guy in years, but that bit has stayed with me forever. Every time I hear father and son, like, mentioned in the same sentence, all I can think of is, you went all the way up to Fatherson for some barbecue? And that brings us to our next match, the 10-minute challenge between the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and Dustin Rhodes, son of the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. So how do we end up at this point? Well, flashback to the weeks before SummerSlam 1990, and we get Sapphire with just kind of these random vignettes where she's getting all sorts of gifts for Code, all that sort of stuff. That eventually leads into the pay-per-view, where as Dusty Rhodes is about to have his match with the Macho Man Randy Savage, Ted DiBiase appears on the interview platform and starts laughing maniacally and reveals that he has been the one giving Sapphire all these presents, basically explaining why Sapphire didn't show up for her match with Queen Sensational Sherry earlier on, in spite of Hacksaw Jim Duggan's best efforts looking for her.
No, I haven't, Dust, but we're all still looking for her.
Later that night, Sapphire takes off with DiBiase and Virgil in a limo as Dusty runs after them and then cuts a very fired up promo in response to all the happenings earlier in the evening. Fast forward a couple of weeks, a couple of months actually, Dustin Rhodes emerges in the WWF. He's sitting front row at the Saturday night's main event match for the Macho Man against Dusty, which they somehow decided to do again in October of 1990. And Ted DiBiase invades the space next to Dustin Rhodes, buys a ticket there, and decides to just hassle him, and eventually beats the piss out of Dustin, angering Dusty. So now the thing is being escalated to the next level, and that leads to this 10-minute challenge match, wherein the rules are, if Dustin takes it to the full time limit, he wins the match. So you think, okay, well, Ted DiBiase should be able to beat this young, quote-unquote, rookie who's been around a couple of years, but rookie for the WWF universe. But it's a de facto beat-the-clock match scenario, which I know they've done on Raw probably once a year for the last 4 years. I always seem to watch when they do the beat-the-clock thing. I don't know. I feel like that's something they might do more frequently that I just perceive anyway. So this angle, as I mentioned in the intro, is it diabolical? Or is it just rehashing an old successful angle? Because it could be a bit of both, as I said earlier, because diabolical in that Dusty Rhodes knew that WCW was looking for a new booker at this point in time. I mean, the Black Scorpion thing was not working. Ole Anderson was on the way out, and the natural person to bring back is Dusty Rhodes, who had been gone for 2 years, and all right, we'll try him again. Maybe he's got some fresh ideas from being gone for a little while. By putting his kid in the spotlight, somehow getting him on WWF television, he can then go to WCW and become a push commodity when Dusty becomes Booker in 1991, which is exactly what happened. Or is it rehashing an old successful angle that had been done in various territories? The example that I'm going to use goes back to Amarillo in the mid-1970s, which is in Bob Backlund's book, where Backlund knew the territory had a similar 10-minute challenge match with Terry Funk, where he took Terry to the limit, to the 10-minute time limit. It basically ends up, you know, prevailing because, well, nobody expected him to do that. This was apparently also done, I think, with Mike Von Erich in World Class with Ric Flair when he was the NWA World Champion. But I refuse to acknowledge anything involving Mike Von Erich because the whole thing just makes me very, very sad to talk about. So we go, and Ted is wearing the proper black and gold tux, my personal favorite, billed from Bel Air, California, because it's the fall, and that is his seasonal residence. I think this is a worthwhile lesson, this being a 10-minute time limit to all TV promotions now. And I know WWE does not do time limits in general, and most of the matches would end in less than that. But for AEW, you should probably do a 10-minute time limit. Now, I know that they did a draw to a time limit draw a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of people were upset about that for whatever reason. But I think that's just because people are not conditioned for it. They don't expect it. So it's just something that they will react negatively to. Dusty, when he comes out, I should point out, he's not wearing a polka dot jacket. He is now at the point where, screw this, I'm not wearing the polka dots anymore because I know I'm on the way out, which is why I think this is more diabolical, because he knows in a couple of months he's not going to be there. So why should I wear these polka dots that they just relentlessly make fun of me for? Even at the Survivor Series, he's not wearing the polka dots. He kind of has like a red thing, but they're definitely not polka dots. Unless he's wearing black polka dots on black trunks. That would be a creative way to get around that. Like Dusty is like, screw you, I'm not going along with your idea. Dustin is only 21 years old here. And it's funny to think about the fact that he's still active in AEW. He's hurt now, but we also saw him on Greetings Battletown in the PWF in 1989, which is where Dusty was between WCW and the WWF. So they're kind of united there. He was also briefly in WCW at the end of 1988 in the Texas Broncos alongside Kendall Windham. USWA, late 1989, he was there as well, but he kind of dropped out of there in early 1990. So it's an easy story to tell. You got a cocky heel in there against the young upstart. I mean, it's probably been done a million times before, but without like doing this 10-minute stipulation like they're doing here. And early on, as they go to lock up, Ted just sort of ducks out of the way four times and is being really, really arrogant about it. And Piper on commentary. Now, he's no Jesse Ventura, but he's certainly getting better than what he was before. At SummerSlam, he seemed to be very confused whether he was a heel announcer, face announcer, or what he was supposed to. He was very much of a tweener, but Piper here is doing the Jesse thing where he's, you know, honestly breaking it down, like the way I would, kind of looking at it with honest eye, like, why is Ted stalling here when he's up against a 10-minute time limit, raising that point, keeping the 10-minute time limit in people's mind? So Ted finally sneaks up from behind, hits a couple back elbows. No Judas effect, though, because, you know, Chris Jericho hadn't come along at that point, and eventually just taunts Dusty from in the ring because he's clearly in control. I do think this match, with the benefit of modern technology, would have been helped by a clock in the bottom corner. It's funny, most of the time I would take out a stopwatch and see if they fudged the time. But with edits, I mean, who knows if they edited a little bit out. And we do get time reads a little bit later on from Finkel, though it starts at a very, very random point that I don't particularly understand. Dustin reverses a cross corner whip and hits a backdrop and two drop kicks and a hip toss, which is babyface offense number 39. Dustin, very early in his career, was way too much trying to be like his father, which is why the Goldust thing, I think, was one of the better things that could have happened to him, where he just is breaking out and doing something completely different. I mean, especially when your father is one of the biggest stars in the history of the business, I mean, it's very hard to differentiate yourself. So, you know, putting on a bunch of makeup and acting androgynous is probably the best way to go about that. DiBiase takes a powder on the outside, but eventually when he gets back in, he regains control, but then he puts his head down, cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, and Dustin gets a backslide for two. And after another slam, DiBiase rolls out, takes another powder. So Dusty, seeing that, you know, he's getting a little sick of this for whatever reason, because, I mean, if Ted wastes time on the outside, well, that's going to hurt him with the 10-minute time limit, but Dusty kind of throws him back in the ring. So I guess this is a de facto lumberjack match. You get a roll-up because Ted is yelling at Dusty on the floor, roll-up for two by Dustin. But then DiBiase regains control, hits that beautiful falling fist drop. I love that move so much. And this is where Howard Finkel weighs in with the odd 6 minutes remaining, which I say odd because in a 10-minute match, why would you start it at 4 minutes? Like, why wouldn't you just wait until 5 minutes and then make the announcement? I really don't get it. As Vince reminds us of everything that's been going on in this feud.
You will recall it was at SummerSlam where the Million Dollar Man used his tremendous bank account to humiliate Dusty Rhodes and buy the managerial services of Sapphire. Only then, not long ago, as we saw the footage again last week, to once again humiliate Dusty Rhodes by jamming that chair into the forehead of his son, Dustin.
I think Vince is just upset that somebody used their sizable bank account to humiliate Dusty Rhodes because he had done it first and he feels like his whole bit was being ripped off. So anyway, DiBiase continues to control in this match, a vertical suplex, and then a second one as Ted just kind of laughs in Dusty's face, but then covers for a two count. And he locks in a chin lock as we get the announcement from Finkel that there are 4 minutes left in this. And Dustin keeps trying to fight out of it with like a top wrist lock, but then Ted hits a knee to the gut to hold on. Get 3 minutes to go, so this thing is definitely slowed down considerably. Dustin elbows out of it, but then when he runs the ropes, he runs right into a knee to the gut from the Million Dollar Man. As Vince and Piper, they lose track of the time at a certain point. Like, they're not paying attention. Finkel says 3 minutes to go. And they're like, how much time is left? Literally, like, 7 seconds afterwards. But then finally, when Finkel says 2 minutes to go, they're back. They pick it up, and they're on the same page again. Get a standing wrist lock, just as we had earlier. And DiBiase is using his smarts as the veteran in there against the quote-unquote rookie. Dustin does elbow out of it, finally, and hits a sunset flip hope spot for two. Ted hits a clothesline and yells outside the ring to the Dream that it's all over now. And with 1 minute to go, he locks in the Million Dollar Dream. As you heard in the intro, Dustin falls to one knee and is just basically just trying to hang on in DiBiase's finisher for the full minute as you get to the end.
He's in trouble now. 30 seconds, 25. Come on, Dustin.
Dustin still hanging in there. The submission hold.
Come on.
Applied by DiBiase. And Dustin is going down.
9, 8. Come on.
7. Come on, Kevin.
Come on, Kevin.
4. Come on.
3.
Come on. 2.
He's done it.
He
Dusty Rhodes. Here's $1 million. Oh, no. What a lousy thing to do. What a lousy, this young man. Dustin Rhodes coming into the ring and going an unbelievable 10 minutes with a more experience. Ted DiBiase, only to have DiBiase turn around and just clobber young Dustin Rhodes with $1 million belt.
This whole thing's kind of emblematic of the relationship between Vince McMahon and Dusty Rhodes. Like, yeah, well, put your kid on television. We're going to have him kind of go over de facto DiBiase by lasting the full 10 minutes. But we're going to make sure that both of you get laid out at the end by DiBiase as he leaves, which I guess is fine. I would have changed the booking of this match, which was way too chin-locky from about minute 6 to minute 9. To basically just having DiBiase hit like his entire array of offense on Dustin and then having him survive it, like the back elbow off the second rope, but have him survive that. And then he locks in the $1 million dream for a while. And, you know, basically he just holds on to the time limit. That's the way I would have done it. I know I say that I'm not a very good booker, but I feel like that would have been preferable to what happened, because once you hit the 6 minute mark, the match kind of stops for 3 minutes, where they're just battling over a top wrist lock, and that's the most relevant thing that's happening. I mean, you're not expecting Dustin to get in a whole lot of offense, and that's fine, but I would have had DiBiase, who has very good offense, you know, as a heel, I mean, probably top three in the WWF. I'd just have him kind of show that off, and that way I think you'd build the sympathy for Dustin even more than just having him in a chin lock for 3 minutes. But like I said, what do I know? I'm not a good booker.
One never knows what to expect here in the World Wrestling Federation. That will certainly be the case 1 week from tomorrow night, next Sunday evening, November 11th at the Boston Garden. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there will be some great matches taking place, but headlining this fantastic card, a 20-man bunkhouse brawl.
Now, you're probably thinking, why is Sean Mooney not telling us what the actual matches on the show are? And the answer is, let me tell you what they were, and you'll understand why he was not saying anything beyond the Bunkhouse Battle Royal. Tito Santana pinned Boris Zukov. Ted DiBiase pinned Dusty Rhodes with a roll-up. Fruit roll-up? WWF Tag Team Champion Bret Hart pinned the Honky Tonk Man with a pile driver. Road Warrior Hawk pinned Demolition Crush with a roll-up. Fruit roll-up? Crush originally won the match with his feet on the ropes for leverage, but the referee ordered the match to continue. Jim Duggan pinned Greg Valentine. Earthquake pinned Tugboat after hitting him with Jimmy Hart's megaphone, and then you have the Bunkhouse Battle Royal. So Demolition Axe not actually having a match, but he's in the Bunkhouse Battle Royal. So for whatever reason, Axe and Crush, and maybe Smash was injured or somewhere else, because there was another show somewhere else, because this was definitely a B show, if not a C show, although I think they were only running two crews at this point. But okay, yeah, it's Bunkhouse Battle Royal. We got the promos. We got more of them. And as a blessing from God himself, we actually get three promos in this event center. First up, from the fake city of Tacula, Mexico, Tito Santana.
A bunkhouse brawl, and it's exactly what it is. Wrestlers can bring whatever they want into the ring and will not be disqualified. The only way to get eliminated is by throwing over the top to the cement floor, and you can get permanently injured, especially if you get thrown by that big giant, that big earthquake. You got the Warlord, you got Dino Bravo. Earthquake and Dino Bravo could be working together. You know, there's a lot that you have to worry about. But Tito Santana has been on those kind of matches before, and he's ready for him, baby. Arriba!
I feel like I've been playing a lot of Tito Santana promos lately, so I really don't have anything left to say about him. So we'll just move on to the next one, which is Demolition, who are now known as the Three Gimps, because they're all wearing masks. This is so ridiculous. Like, okay, you're not allowed to wear face paint anymore because we have the Road Warriors here. It's like, okay, you were in the WWF wearing face paint, not only before them, but before the Ultimate Warrior. In fact, I'm trying to think of others who were wearing face paint prior to Demolition. I guess maybe Kamala, but come on. I mean, that was kind of a pre-existing thing carried over from the territories. So, all right, Demolition. I mean, it's bad enough that they're wearing, like, dominatrix or whatever S&M outfits, but now they got to wear gimp masks, too.
Bring out the gimp. I think the gimp's sleeping. Well, I guess you just have to go wake him up now, won't you?
Boston Gardens, you put 20 wrestlers in the ring. Tell them they can do anything they want. Tugboat's in there. Earthquake's in there. Roddy Piper's in there. The new Demolition.
Anything you want, boys.
And come as you are. I know you goofballs in Boston know about come as you are. I've seen the way you dress. Well, Demolition's got everything we need to get the job done.
Legion of Doom, and you're gonna be in there. We can't wait, because it's us three against you two and the Boston Guards. Ha ha!
As I mentioned earlier, reading the lineup, Smash was not there for whatever reason, but at least Boston got to say a tearful goodbye to Demolition Axe. I don't know if he gave more of a crap on that show than he did at the Survivor Series. Actually, I know the answer to that, and it is yes. So now, Demolition's nemesis, the Hart Foundation, who defeated them for the tag titles at SummerSlam, and then basically Demolition immediately fell on hard times to the point where they're adopting gimp masks later on. So here's Bret Hart. He's going to take a page out of Earthquake's book from earlier, his fellow Canadian. And this is the whole idea of doing local promos, I would guess. Instead of mentioning the teams, Bret is going to drill down a little bit more and actually mention specific athletes from Boston at that time.
Everybody in Boston is backing the Hart Foundation in the bunkhouse brawl. Wade Boggs called me up. He wants to give me a baseball bat. Chris Nyland called me up. He wants to give me a hockey stick and his skates.
Hey, well, Larry Bird called me up. He wants to give me a knee brace to come in there and pound and pound and pound and hit him on the head. You can bring anything you want.
You know something, Hitman? Maybe we should bring these belts in
and drop them on a couple of people's heads in there. Anything goes in the bunkhouse brawl, baby!
Everybody knows who Larry Bird is. Most people should know who Wade Boggs is, considering that he inducted Mr. Perfect in the WWE Hall of Fame back in 2007, and also the legendary story about him drinking 70 Miller Lights on a road trip from New York to Seattle in, I don't know how many hours that would have been, like 10, but it's very hard to kind of do the math of, but it's been verified by a couple of different people independently. And Chris Nyland, the other name thrown in there, he was kind of the archetype for a goon hockey player in the mid-90s. I'm not talking about the Bill Irwin character from the mid-90s. I'm talking about a guy who would fight a lot, although Nyland could score goals here and there. He scored in the teens, and I think he scored 20 one year for the Canadiens. In fact, that 90-91 season that the show would have taken place in, he was named to the All-Star team as kind of a, I don't know how to put it, like a nepotism pick, because the Bruins coach was also coaching the Wales Conference All-Star team at that time. Nyland, also known for, he was married to the stepdaughter of mobster Whitey Bulger, the guy basically that Jack Nicholson was playing in The Departed. I mean, that was basically him. He's married to his stepdaughter for 26 years. Gave him his 1986 Stanley Cup ring. That's what Bulger had, the Stanley Cup ring that Nyland won with the Canadiens. And he was also arrested, I want to say about a decade ago, for shoplifting a swimsuit from South Shore Plaza in Braintree, Massachusetts. So, I don't know. This is why I like local promos so much, especially when they're the Boston Garden shows.
All right, hi, good everybody. We are counting down to the Survivor Series, the annual Thanksgiving tradition.
That would actually be the fourth and final Survivor Series that was held on Thanksgiving night. The following year, they held it on Thanksgiving Eve, which continued through 94, and then 95, they moved it to the Sunday, and it kind of moved all over. In 97, I think it was November 9th, the infamous Montreal Screwjob, so it was much earlier in the month, depending on, you know, how things fell on the calendar. This Survivor Series in Hartford, Connecticut, at the, well, it's now the XL Arena, but it was the Hartford Civic Center back then. And I've been there for a couple events over the years. I went to a Bruins-Whalers game in 1996, which the Bruins lost 2-0 in rather embarrassing fashion, but that team wasn't very good. And I also saw Pearl Jam there in May of 2010, which holds the distinction of being, I think, one of 6 or 7 Pearl Jam shows in the Northeast. Steve Bennett of the Sportscasters has not been to. I'm just having fun with you, Steve, but that was a good show because it was one of the funniest things that I've ever seen at a concert. Nothing to do with what was going on stage. People slipping on the same thing of beer 3 times in the span of about 90 seconds, and they were all carrying beer, and they were gradually making it worse and even more slippery. It was I don't think that's ever going to be topped at a concert that I ever attend. So Mean Gene, for whatever reason, clearly this is probably just something he just says, you know, just to say it, but he's being hassled while he's traveling around the country.
By the way, I've been asked as I travel around the country about the rules. Teams of four each going against each other. The only way a man can be eliminated is by pin, submission, or count out.
Who are these people? I'm trying to picture the scenario where Gene Okerlund is at the bar at the airport, let's say, and he's just trying to enjoy a nice gin and tonic, and people keep coming up to him. Like, the sixth or seventh person who comes up to him and asks about the Survivor Series rules, like, expect me, Gene. Like, he's probably about four gin and tonics in, and he just kind of snaps him, like, hey, can't any of you motherfuckers watch the previous 3 years' worth of shows and figure out the rules for yourself? Of course, that kind of thing couldn't happen now because everybody's got to keep their cool because everybody's got cameras in their pocket and will post it to YouTube at the first available opportunity. So we're going to run down what the show looks like for the Survivor Series coming up in a couple of weeks. And I mentioned this on Twitter, and this bears repeating, that I love the little driver's license photos that you have for each of the guys. Like, we see the Hulkamaniacs, and it just makes me wonder, what is the story behind these photographs? Do they just line them up like it's the DMV or the RMV or whatever it's called in your state and be like, all right, just smile or don't smile or try to look menacing, you know, if you're one of the heels? Like, Tugboat is smiling way too much, I think. In fact, kind of harms his credibility a little bit. And speaking of credibility, you get Dino Bravo, who looks totally bug-eyed. And I notice that out of the eight guys in that match between the Hulkamaniacs and the Natural Disasters, Dino Bravo, the only clean-shaven guy. I don't know why I was looking at that. You know what I think it is? I've just become more aware of facial hair ever since I got some of my own. But back to those little driver's license photos. I wanted to do a show that's just devoted to those. But then again, this is an audio podcast. So maybe I should just do like a YouTube show. Do like my top 35 Survivor Series driver's license photos from, let's say, 88 to 91. Because I don't remember ever seeing that for 87. And even in 88, you might not see it so much because they had to make so many damn substitutions down the stretch. So we're going to hear from the aforementioned Natural Disasters, Dino Bravo, Earthquake, of course, Jimmy Hart alongside, and also a team that Jimmy Hart would go on to manage in WCW, the Faces of Fear, Haku, who become known as Mang in WCW, of course, and the Barbarian, which effectively having those two guys there cancels out Dino Bravo being there, but also at the same time, late 1985 WWF viewers would say, hey, it's nice to see Dino Bravo reunited with Haku, formerly known as King Tonga, because they were briefly a team in late 85.
Hulkamaniac! I am Tonga Brothers, the biggest, the baddest, and the meanest team in the WWF at the Survivor Series. I'm saying, Johnny Ray, we were all at their careers, and we were all advanced to the grand finale.
Oh, Hogan, you never thought about a team like this. You look at this. Nobody remembers the national disaster.
People are all Hogan up again. We coming to town, and we coming to destroy you. No one will survive.
No team can destroy the national disaster.
My enjoyment of that 45-second blurb was not harmed by the fact that I couldn't understand anything that was being said because they were either talking over each other or, in the case of the Barbarian, when he was speaking, I just can't understand him. And I think back, there was an earlier episode of Greetings from Allentown where they did one of these local promos, and Barbarian is with Bobby Heenan, and Heenan says something, and Barbarian says something, and objectively, the Barbarian did better on the promo than Bobby Heenan did, which is just some sort of miracle thing. To go back to what I was saying last week about college football, it would be like if the Citadel beat Alabama by like 20 points. Like that's how much of a miracle that was. So now we go to the Hulkamaniacs with Hulk Hogan, and he's going to get a little bit more. Well, looks like he got about 45 plus seconds that the Natural Disasters team got. But for whatever reason, they decided to record this in a weird echo chamber.
Well, you know something, Hulkamaniacs? Everybody knows that the whole WWF is in a state of chaos, man. All these superstars are vying for positions. Everybody's tugging for the top, man. But a lot of the bad guys out there seem to be getting in a lot of extra team shots lately. Well, now that I've whooped around the whole WWF, I'm confident that the team of Hulkamaniacs that I've assembled here is going to be the craziest bunch of maniacs I've ever been around. Can you imagine what Hacksaw's going to do when he gets a hold of somebody with that 2x4, dudes?
It's going to be a war out there, no question about it. We're not going to work together like no well-oiled machine, but we're going to get things done. We're going to beat people up.
That's right. It's like Hack says. It's anchors away, full steam ahead, and the only thing on the radar screen is the natural disasters.
Haku, you're on the big boss man's 10 most wanted list, and after I get through with you, Heenan, watch out.
Friggin' tugboat with the nautical references. And he also calls Hacksaw Jim Duggan Hack. I don't think I've ever heard him called that before. Hack? Like, I know that the Sandman, his nickname was Hack, and that's why he went by Hardcore Hack when he went to WCW. But you couldn't say Jim? Well, I guess you don't really refer to him by first name. You could just call him Hacksaw, for God's sakes. I don't know. I mean, like Dusty says, hey, Hacksaw, have you seen Sapphire? I mean, that's the normal way of addressing. But it seems like that they were practicing for Saturday night's main event interviews, because a little too punny there, a little too cute between the boss man and tugboat at the end. Up next, the Vipers versus the Visionaries, the five clean-shaven guys in that group. Again, don't know why I'm paying attention to that. And Phantom of the Warlord is on the Visionaries' side of the ledger. And they all survived the match, which the whole team survives, which something they had not done in the previous 3 years because, well, I don't know if they were just saving it for something, but if you were going to do it, this was the time to do it because you needed to fill out that quote-unquote right side of the ledger, excuse me, the heel side, depending on what you want to call it. I think about that Vipers team way too much and just the four guys involved with it being Jake the Snake Roberts, Superfly Jimmy Snuka, Marty Jannetty, and Shawn Michaels. And think about the fact that Shawn Michaels is the most put together out of all of them. And I mean like the least drug-addled out of all of those guys. Like he's the most normal one. I mean, let's think about that for a second. Shawn Michaels, who basically spent 4 or 5 years just completely pilled up out of his mind, is the most stable and normal guy on that team. And then they have like the interview in the shower at the pay-per-view itself. It's like I half expect that guy from Goonies in the shower who's wearing the eye patch to be in the background, but alas, it's just not to be. The Dream Team taking on the Million Dollar Team. And in that little driver's license photo, and I tweeted about this, Dusty Rhodes, a little too happy with the open mouth. I'm not sure why he's smiling that much here in, late in his WWF stint, but I would still watch a 30 to 60 minute documentary on the making of that photograph. The other thing that's interesting, since you know you only see three of the guys from the Million Dollar Team, because you get Undertaker as the mystery guy, and they do a very good job of not making the silhouette look obvious. Well, of course, these days in WWE, every one of the silhouettes kind of resembles Cesaro, or maybe that's just me projecting, wishing that Cesaro would be the secret partner in every case. Greg Valentine, who has got the black hair, as Gorilla calls him Boxcar, which is something another one of those things that pops me every single time when he calls him Boxcar in reference to Boxcar Willie. Greg Valentine facing a team called the Dream Team. How ironic, given that Greg Valentine was a tag team champion as a member of the Dream Team with Brutus Beefcake, and then along with Dino Bravo for much of the year 1987 as well. These Survivor Series matches are really bad for tag teams because the singles guys are always going to get preference, and the tag team guys are just going to be shunted along, and they're going to be pinned with a clothesline or basically some sort of weak move. And speaking of being pinned with weak moves, get the Alliance, Nikolai Volkoff, Tito Santana, and the Bushwhackers taking on the Mercenaries, which is Boris Zukov, Captain, Sergeant Slaughter. He's a captain and a sergeant. How does that work? In the Orient Express of Sato and Tanaka, so not even the good version of it. And I spoke about that match earlier, and I love it because it's so terrible, but I love the way that it played out with the three guys getting eliminated on Slaughter's side, and then he methodically works his way through. But again, the Bushwhackers get pinned so casually and so quickly. I mean, not as quickly as the Orient Express was. I mean, they came out of this looking terrible. Good thing that they got to have that Royal Rumble match against the Rockers, one of the best matches on WWF pay-per-view, at least in the first 10 years, let's say 85 to 95 in WWF or any sort of super show. So I've spoken enough about that one. So on to the perfect team versus the Warriors. Now, these are two great teams. I guess the perfect team, not so much. But the Warriors, I guess they're called the Ultimate Warriors. But you got the Super Warrior babyfaces. You got the Ultimate Warrior. You got Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich, the Modern Day Warrior, as he was known in World Class, and the Legion of Doom, who were known as the Road Warriors everywhere else they were. So it was a team that made complete and total sense. And even though I'm not a huge Ultimate Warrior guy, I love them for at least from that perspective. Now, they're all kind of past their peak, Kerry being well past his peak, quite honestly. I mean, for various obvious reasons. Legion of Doom, Road Warriors, I would say that they peaked in 87 and 88. And it was a slow decline through 91. And then it just really accelerated. And the Warrior, well, let's face it, they had already probably made up their mind by this point that he was not working as champion and that, you know, the time was going to come to get the belt off him. Most people would have figured WrestleMania for that, but then Royal Rumble comes around, all of a sudden Slaughter has got the belt. And before we get to Mr. Perfect's team, we are going to hear from this collection of warriors.
Surviving the perfect team is of no concern to any one of these warriors, but if you're the one that has to make the sacrifice, where do you go from there?
You are perfect. The perfect losers, the perfect team to be beaten by this team. You're going down as Survivor.
Demolition, I ain't no Robert Redford, and Animal, he ain't no Tom Cruise. But we never had to cover our face with masks. Maybe it's because you're ashamed of something. Maybe it's because you don't want to show the damage we already did to your face. Tell them, big man. Demolition, whether it's paint or whether it's masks, Mr. Perfect, you've all jumped heel from behind, and now you're going to pay the ultimate price. The Warriors are coming. You're going down. Survivor Series.
This would be kind of a fun exercise. Take every Survivor Series team from the first 5 years and make it the best possible, the Logan's Run version of every single guy. This team with Warrior and Kerry and the Road Warriors, Legion of Doom, They're definitely in contention for that number one spot. Of course, I think one of the sleepers is probably that Hogan team from the first year, because you get Hogan, Bigelow, and you get the best version of Patera, you get the best version of Paul Orndorff, and then the best version of Morocco as well. So that one's kind of sneaky good if you're doing a Logan's Run recreation of everything. Fortunately, we're not going to hear from Mr. Perfect and his three gimps. Instead, we got to save this time for Gene Okerlund, who explains to us how this match of survival finale at the Survivor Series is going to work.
That's your lineup, and you talk about your action. Hey, by the way, all surviving members from all the teams will be brought back at the end of the evening for the grand finale match of survival. I've got a scorecard in front of me, and I'm just speculating out loud here. It's possible on one side of the ledger, only the Ultimate Warrior could survive. And it's conceivable on the other side you could have four or five or six members, like, say, from the natural disasters, Earthquake and Dino Bravo. From the Mercenaries, perhaps Sergeant Slaughter. From the Million Dollar Team, Ted DiBiase. From the Visionaries, the model Rick Martel. It could be a four-on-one, a five-on-one, five-on-two. Any combination is possible.
All I have to say is good thing we didn't have 1996 Hulk Hogan booking this show, because we could have had a situation where the Visionaries, the Million Dollar Team, the Mercenaries, and the Perfect Team all face Hulk Hogan in the match of survival 16-on-1, but we would have to wait until Uncensored 1996. And anyway, they would cut that down. It would only be an 8-on-2, I guess 8-on-3 if you count Booty Man or whatever the hell Beefcake was calling himself at that point. Oh, yeah. And there's the egg, too. But like I said, they built it too well. If they were guilty of anything, they were applying a pro wrestling build to something that probably did not warrant it.
Monday MacGyver's caught up in a mad dash for minions and cash. Henry Winkler, Abe Vigoda, Dick Buckus, Marion Ross, and Rich Little star on MacGyver. Then,
get ready for some football!
The undefeated New York Giants head to the Hoosier Dome to meet the Indianapolis Colts on ABC's NFL Monday Night Football.
It's a time for decisions.
Are we planning to spend the rest of our lives together or not?
If you and I were to get married, you'd just end up hating me. And I know you think you wouldn't, but you would.
Coach, Tuesday.
I never really watched MacGyver, but geez, I wish I watched that one. It was pretty star-studded. Henry Winkler, Abe Vigoda. That was not a sexy Monday Night Football matchup between the Giants and the Colts. Yes, the Giants were undefeated at the time. They went to 8-0 on the season in that game, but the Colts were 2-6. They had lost to the Patriots. It was the only Patriots win that year. It was 24-7 victory over the Giants. Not much of note in that one. Phil Simms, still the starting quarterback. Giants, of course, would go on to win the Super Bowl that season against Buffalo down in Tampa. So up next, we got Mr. Perfect, former Intercontinental Champion, taking on Randy Jackson. No, not the one from... not the one from American Idol, or who used to be on American Idol. Is that show even still on the air? I think it changed networks. Now, why did Mr. Perfect have to lose to Kerry? Why did they have to do that? Why not just do a screwy finish and just make Kerry chase for a little bit and prove himself that he could stay straight for a little while? Because if you do that, then Perfect has this super long title reign that has the added benefit of burying the Honky Tonk Man's long title reign, because Perfect's would have ended up being longer because you extend it from May of 1990, which is when the tournament finale would have aired, and you take that to the end of August of 91 when he loses it to Brett. That's 15 months. That's longer than what the Honky Tonk Man had. Since Honky left at the end of 1990, you know, you could have stuck it to him in that way. But oh no, no, we had to have a stupid Kerry reign where it basically, I don't want to say it devalued the belt, but it certainly did not do anything for it. Heenan coming to the ring, they do the towel toss, blind, and Heenan always in the correct position to catch it. He just says to Perfect, this is his instructions, you know what you're doing, take him apart. And I feel like that's pretty good enhancement match advice. As Roddy Piper on commentary references wanting to face Mr. Perfect, and he did on a dark match, which I think was on a WWE unreleased, one of the ones that came out in the last year or two, lost clean via the Perfectplex and then shook Perfect's hand afterwards, which I think may have led people to think that Piper was going to turn heel at a certain point and perhaps feud with the Ultimate Warrior, but I think that was all newsletter talk that didn't really go anywhere. But as Perfect gets underway in this bout, we are going to hear from his three gimps in the inset promo.
He's the perfect wrestler, and we're the perfect partners,
and that's why we're the perfect tag team.
Despite Heenan's earlier directive, you know what you're doing, take him apart, Perfect actually gets surprised, a reversal of an Irish whip and a hip toss by Jackson, but then almost immediately right after, and I swear to God, it felt like something was edited out of the match, Perfect actually fires right back, and then it's right to the Perfectplex, where, once again, he does a, now you're going to see the Perfectplex.
Oh, well, Mr. Perfect has been backdropped in his obvious...
Here's the big issue that I have with it. At the time, I'm 11 years old. I'm very impressionable. I'm watching this in the northern suburbs of Boston, but a little bit further north than that, there's an impressionable 13-year-old watching this by the name of John Cena. And he says to himself after seeing Mr. Perfect do this, if I ever become a professional wrestler in the WWF, or if they have to change their name for whatever reason because the Wildlife Fund wins control of the name, I'm going to call all of my spots at the top of my lungs. And look what happened, okay? It all speaks for itself. Little pitchy dog. And I mean, I'm just saying that because Randy Jackson is in this match. So Heenan holds Jackson up after the bout for Perfect to hit a running dropkick for no real reason. I mean, why did this guy have to lose to Kerry at SummerSlam? And why did it have to be in like 5 minutes? I mean, I know that Kerry couldn't really stay upright for more than 5 minutes at a time, but my God. I mean, it would have been so perfect if he had held on to that title from the moment he won it in that tournament. He passes the Honky Tonk Man, and it would make Brett beating him at the Madison Square Garden kind of like the Ultimate Warrior winning it at Madison Square Garden. It would have made it an even bigger moment than it was. And before they go to the event center, they show kids by the egg, and they're wondering what exactly is going on with that egg. And I said that I, in an earlier episode, the December of 91, where I talked extensively about Survivor Series from that year then, that I ordered the show after not getting WrestleMania 6 nor SummerSlam 90. I ordered it mainly because I wanted to know what was in the freaking egg. Needless to say, I was a little bit disappointed. So we go to the event center, and more, please, promos for this Bunkhouse Battle Royal. I mean, God, what a pleasant surprise this has been. And up next, oh, crap. We got Dino Bravo. I posted this on Twitter. Dino Bravo in a Montreal Canadiens jersey, which to me is a combination of all the bad things.
The Bunkhouse Brawl right there at the Boston Garden. You know what I like about it? There are no rules. A lot of tough individual in there. You're talking about Legion of Doom. You're talking about Demolition. Big Axel Jim Duncan. That fat tugboat. Well, I guarantee you, my friend Earthquake is going to be there. And he promised me I would win the Bunkhouse Brawl. And Earthquake never breaks a promise. Take it from the world's strongest man. I'm going
to
win it.
You know, everybody wants to point out the Boston accent and how the R's get removed from some words and then put into other words where it shouldn't necessarily be there. Well, how about Dino Bravo with his H relocation program? Axaw Jim Duggan and the Earthquake. The Earthquake. Apparently he's making bread. I don't know what the hell is going on here. But his Canadiens jersey does not have a player number nor a name on it. So I just want to yell at him. Oh, who's your favorite player, super fan? Do I like Patrick Roy? No. Do I like Denis Savard? No. My favorite player is blank. So, okay. And the other thing is he called it the Boston Gardens again. Can we get one freaking person or team? Maybe Legion of Doom will have better luck. Will they call it the Boston Garden?
A Boston Garden. A bunkhouse brawl. Large men. Tugboat. Earthquake. Bravo. DiBiase. But it don't make no difference to us how big you are. What makes a difference to us is us. Tell them, big man. If you got any guts at all, just show up. We dare you to.
I blame Canada for this, because Toronto, it's Maple Leaf Gardens, so everybody thinks that it's the Boston Gardens. But nobody ever says Madison Square Gardens. How come nobody ever pluralizes that? There's too many animal promos on this show.
Other great matches will be taking place as well, but once again, let's review all the participants in the Bunkhouse Brawl. They include the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, the Warlord, Tugboat, Rhythm and Blues, the Legion of Doom, Tito Santana, the newcomer, Sava Simba.
That's Tony Atlas. That ain't no Sava Simba. That's Tony Atlas with walking around, look like some birds real cold the way he's walking around. All them feathers, who's he trying to fool?
Hey, said that it saved his life, so that's good enough for me. But it cut off Piper from ever saying Tony Atlas ever again, which is truly a crime. And they go back to Vince and Roddy, who tell us that next week, Legion of Doom will be facing the Orient Express. Apparently, this is some sort of AWA super challenge from, like, earlier in the 80s to the late 80s. I don't know. We get another LOD promo. I'm not playing three animal promos on the same show. That is just not happening. But Fuji says he's got a special plan for that bout, which would be him reuniting with Demolition, who would come down and try to help out. Excuse me, the three Gimps. Which I personally believe that Axe said, I don't want Fuji, but he got outvoted 2-1, which is why he left so promptly. That's the kayfabe explanation I'm coming up with for that. So that is it for the WWF Superstars from November 3rd, 1990. Right here on the Pro Wrestling Only feed this week, we got a new Strong Style story as the guys talk about the much maligned tag league for New Japan this year. I'm not sure I quite understand all the changes that took place with that compared to the older tag leagues. I feel like my knowledge of those really stops around the end of the 80s because I've always had to research like, oh, the British Bulldogs were in the 85 tag league or whatever and then come back. So I don't know. Maybe I should brush up on that sort of stuff. We have the Bigfoot Pro Wrestling podcast looking at independent wrestling from the Pacific Northwest. And speaking of that region, one of the most prominent wrestlers in the world, the wrestling genius, Daniel Makabe, joined the WorldCast guys for a tribute to the Destroyer. Certainly looking forward to checking that out. Dropped last night as I taped this. And the Days of Thunder podcast looking at WCW from the year 1998 at this moment will be dropping later today as this podcast drops. Now, for the friends of the show, the wrestling podcast about nothing with Mike Crockett and this week, Brawler Malonis, no Brian Fury as, while they taped the show at his New England Pro Wrestling Academy, Brian Fury off in Disney World, which is where he was. I guess he was there for a full week. Well, when Crockett was done talking about the New England Pro Wrestling Academy, which apparently is just filled with pictures of Brian Fury that are, like, signed by him, autographed to himself, or at least that's the image that Mike was giving, they talk about how toxic Twitter is. And that's a great subject, because you know what I say about every 5 or 6 days? Wrestling Twitter is exhausting. I mean, it's just crazy. I literally am saying it that often, just either out loud to myself or in a chat or somewhere. And they brought back the segment where Mike reads mean tweets about Brian Malonis, but he had trouble actually finding any. So what a good 2019 this has been for Brawler Malonis and the Bouncers. Well, apparently, free agency is just around the corner for him. Now, on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Michael Quinn, and Joe Morata, who I have a bone to pick with him. Yeah, I heard what you said on the show, okay? You think it's just some sort of throwaway line that you say it on your podcast, it goes one in one ear, out the other. Not with me, okay? I'm not going to let it stand that you said that the NWO B-Team theme sucks. That this will not stand, okay? I'm not letting that comment go by. I cannot believe you would say such a thing, and I demand that you issue a retraction, ASAP. Thank you very much, but you guys did spend 11 minutes kissing Johnny B. Badd's ass at the beginning of the show, which I certainly enjoyed this week, so I don't know, maybe that was kind of a mitigating factor that I should take into account. On the Sportscasters with Steve Bennett coming up, he's got Jeff Passan, baseball writer extraordinaire. Maybe he'll explain why we have to wait until April 15th every year for free agents to sign. I mean, baseball is headed for another labor war circa, you know, like the 80s and early 90s. When this next CBA ends, there's going to be an extended lockout. So long as the players' union actually has the kind of stones that they used to have, and I don't think that they do. So, you know, let's maybe get somebody in there other than Tony Clark, who's not going to sell out his membership at the first possible opportunity. But anyway, you don't want to hear me talk about baseball.
Baseball, baseball, baseball.
But there are just some things that I have to know at the end of the day, which is why I'm going to tune into the Sportscasters with my good friend Steve Bennett when Jeff Passan is on there. Now, I'm going to change gears quickly to another sport, one that is actually played when it's 20 degrees out, which is what it is as I'm taping this here in the middle of November in the heart of New England. It's time for Vinny Vegas Corner. Went 2-1 last week to go to 16-14 on the season. Why the hell did I decide to pick a freaking college game? I don't know anything about it. It's just, oh, I got to pick against LSU because they look stupid at the end of that game. And then I remembered, oh, yeah, that's right. They have that Joe Burrow guy at quarterback who I have to remember his name is not Joe Morrow, the former defenseman for the Bruins and the Penguins and other teams. It's Joe Burrow. So I hope he enjoys Cincinnati. I hope he enjoys that disgusting chili that they serve out over there. Anyway, it's just going to be three straight up NFL games, two of them from prime time this week. I'll start with the Thursday night game. The Pittsburgh Steelers are in Cleveland to take on the Browns, who picked up a win against the Buffalo Bills this past week, which sounds impressive since the Bills were 6-2, but it was kind of a weak 6-2. And the Browns did everything they could to try and lose that game, including one point where they ran 8 plays inside the 3-yard line and came away with 0 points. It's just a remarkable sequence and a reminder that for some reason, the Cleveland Browns, they change coaches all the time. And yes, because they keep hiring bad ones, but how did they manage to find Freddie Kitchens, who might be the worst one that they have ever had? I cannot believe how bad the Browns have looked at times, given some of the talent on the field. Yeah, I did expect Baker Mayfield to regress, but not quite this much. Now, as for the Pittsburgh Steelers, Mason Rudolph is no great shakes, but clearly the Steelers have decided that 2019, we're going to evolve ourselves into the team that just plays games in the teens and wins games with their defense. And I looked at the point spread for this game, and the Browns are actually favored by 3 points, and I could not believe it. Freddie Kitchens versus Mike Tomlin, who I do have criticism for, but this is Freddie Kitchens we're talking about here. So I will take the Steelers getting 3 points in Cleveland. Carolina is hosting the Atlanta Falcons, and Carolina is only giving 6 points in this game. And apparently, the Falcons' victory over the Saints in New Orleans last weekend made some sort of impression. But what people are forgetting is the Saints always seem to lose one of those games every year that's just completely inexplicable. It was a rivalry game. They were coming off the bye. I don't know. Apparently, they slept through their alarm. I don't know if it was AM, PM, or the volume, or whatever it was. But Carolina, kind of in a must-win spot, they want to say, in that NFC title, NFC wild card race. That is Atlanta. That was kind of their Super Bowl last week against the New Orleans Saints. And I'm not just saying that because when they went up by 2 touchdowns, Matt Ryan immediately threw an interception. Kind of made me think that, yes, that indeed was their Super Bowl. But I'm going to go with Carolina giving 6 against the Falcons. And then finally, in a game that sounds like a rerun from last year with a few minor changes, Kansas City playing Los Angeles in Mexico. Except this time, maybe the game will actually get played in Mexico because it got moved back to Los Angeles last year. It was the Rams and the Chiefs in that case playing a game that ended up, I think, 51-48. This one is the Chargers taking on the Chiefs, who are really in a tough spot after losing that game to the Titans in pretty embarrassing fashion. When you get owned by Ryan Tannehill, he's not the worst quarterback in the world, but you always... It really does damage to your self-esteem when it happens. And trust me, as a Patriots fan, he did it to us a couple of times down in Miami. And it really hurts. But I really think that the Chiefs will turn it around this week. We got another... I mean, Patrick Mahomes looked like he did not miss a beat at all. I don't trust this Chargers team as far as I can throw them. And the fact that the Chiefs are only giving 3.5, it feels like a bargain. So I'll take Kansas City giving 3.5 against the Chargers in Mexico. So Pittsburgh +3 in Cleveland Thursday. Carolina -6 against Atlanta on Sunday. And Kansas City giving 3.5 against the Chargers. For Vinny Vegas Corner, Week 11. So I'm going to be down in Florida next week, which makes the production of the next show a little bit, you know, off the normal routine. Not going to be recording it while I'm down there. I'm going to be doing the thing where I record it way in advance, like I'm taping down at Disney World. Well, it's kind of fitting that I would be going to Florida. I got to tape everything well in advance. I'm going to leave it as a surprise because I've been batting around like 4 or 5 different things to do. That would be kind of a full show, so do stay tuned for that. I will post on social media as to what that is going to be. But while you wait for next week's show and you listen to the other fine programs that I mentioned earlier during the plug segment, please give a 5-star review to Greetings from Allentown on iTunes, Apple Music. That is greatly appreciated because it provides what is known as social proof that you're listening to and enjoying this wonderful podcast that I enjoy bringing to you every single week. I thank you so much for listening, and do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
From the bottom of my heart, apologize to the big boss man's mother.